Do you ever wonder what it took to get words like selfie in the dictionary, or where new words come from, or what happens to words when they die? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are going to talk with the word detective this hour. He is actually the author of The Word Detective, searching for the meaning of it all at the Oxford English Dictionary. And we will welcome your questions about how words get into the dictionary, how technology is affecting dictionaries and language. Maybe you have a favorite word. Maybe you have a word to describe how cold it is outside that you want to share. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. John Simpson is the former chief editor of the Oxford English Dictionary, where he helped take the dictionary online. He is an emeritus fellow of Kellogg College, Oxford, and he writes and researches widely on lexical, literary, and historical issues. He is the author of The Word Detective, Searching for the Meaning of It All at the Oxford English Dictionary. Good morning. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Joy.
Well, you know, I wanted to start with this word that is in the news. The Oxford English Dictionary recently announced that its word of the year for 2016 is post-truth. And we have here a clip from WNYC's On the Media program showing how this has been used a lot in the media.
We are now living in this sort of a post-truth campaign.
Seems to be the post-truth election in a lot of
post-truth political world.
So, word of the year, post-truth. What do you make of that pick?
What do I make of the word post-truth? Well, I was never actually involved in choosing words of the year when I was at Oxford. I was always happier with the idea of picking a word of the year from 1623 or something like that, rather than a modern word. But I think actually this is actually quite a good choice for word of the year, because it's good for describing the sort of ambivalent feeling we have about reality these days. So you have truth in the past, and then you realize that the truth is maybe not everything it's cracked up to be, and some of it's fake. And then we move beyond that into a post-truth environment, and that's supposedly where we are now. So I thought it was quite a good choice for Word of the Year. I thought a few years ago selfie was a good choice for Word of the Year. I don't always agree with the ones they choose, but I thought they did quite well this year.
Well, how does talk a little bit about how a word like post-truth all of a sudden becomes a part of our language?
Yeah, we don't often invent words out of absolutely nowhere. So most of the new words that we talk about today are subtle shifts of old words or compounds formed by existing elements in the language. So they're not completely new. So a new word is going to be a compound like post-truth, for example. And in the old days, for a word like that to get into the Oxford English Dictionary, all we'd have required was our readers to have read texts for us and wrote on index cards sentences containing words they thought were useful, which went into our card files in Oxford. All we'd have needed was maybe five examples over a five-year spread of a word before we'd consider putting it into the dictionary. But nowadays, with the internet, that sort of number is completely blown out of the water, because you can get 10,000 examples of a common spelling mistake, and we wouldn't want to be prompted to put that into the dictionary. So you're looking for widespread evidence from different genres, from newspapers, from books, from magazines, from all sorts of different registers of language, before a word like post-truth is considered for the OED or for any dictionary in that matter.
Yeah. So, I'm trying to also just get a handle on how this happens. Somebody writes post-truth. We live in a post-truth society, and somebody picks that up, and someone says, "Oh, that's clever," and then they report it on TV,
so, yeah.
And that's what
yeah.
happens.
It just feels like the right it feels like an appropriate word to use, so people think that it's a nice shorthand way of saying something that they would have probably spent a couple of sentences trying to describe. So, it becomes a shorthand way of describing something that's appropriate for the time now.
Yeah. And so selfie is one you also thought was a good pick for word of the year. Selfie is, when it's word of the year, does it end up in the dictionary right away?
Not necessarily right away. It usually ends up in smaller dictionaries right away, but the big OED takes a bit more of a historical view. So we'll probably wait for... selfie is now in the OED, but, for example, I think today the OED is publishing a new set of new words, and this is the first time today that the word Brexit has appeared in the OED, even though we've been talking about it for the last couple of years or so. They wanted to wait until it had found a place and a meaning several years after it was first used, rather than racing things into dictionaries straight away. If you race something into a big historical dictionary like the OED, then you only find you have to go back to it 6 months later and change the definition as it shifts, as it finds its place in the language.
Yeah, well, it makes sense that you want to make sure that it's established, but I'm wondering, has it ever happened that some new word that maybe was a word of the year it just kind of falls by the wayside? People just stop using it, and it's an obsolete word.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly does happen with words. I don't think because we tend to wait a while before we put it into the dictionary, it usually means it's gained a place. I can't think of a word of the year that isn't relevant anymore. But it certainly does happen with some words. From our point of view, because they've died, if we put them into the dictionary, it doesn't matter, because from our point of view, it's just... evidence of what happened to the language at some time in the past. You see, the OED deals with the English language from 1500 years ago, when English was first started emerging from the Germanic languages, right up to the present day. So even if something in the 17th century is no longer current or relevant or important, it's still important as a sort of a little spark or flash of what happened to the language in the past.
Mm-hmm. I imagine you get the question, what's your favorite word?
I do. I mean, I do say somewhere in the word detector that I don't really have a favorite word, because when I was at work, we all had to be not exactly white-coated scientists, but we had to take a very scientific, objective approach to language, and we were interested in aspects of words rather than favoritism in words. On the other hand, since I retired, I feel I'm slightly relaxed on that, and at the moment, I've been telling people that my favorite word is detective, which, for obvious reasons.
Yeah, well, that's a cool word.
It's quite fun, because we didn't used to have detective as a word until about the 1830s or 1840s. We had to detect, and we had detection, and sometimes that was used in the context of crime. But the point of what was happening in society in the 1830s and 1840s was that detective agencies and Metropolitan Police in London and the French Police Service were creating plainclothes departments. They were discovering that was another way of attacking crime, detecting problems, rather than just sending out blue-coated policemen or whatever. So by the 1830s and 40s, there were these plainclothes police officers, and they needed a name for them, and they came up with the word detective. So it fits the sort of social and cultural changes at the time quite nicely. So, yeah, I'm happy with that being my favorite word at the moment.
Yeah, and it's a catchy title, too. Is that how you would describe your job, a word detective?
Well, it came up because when I retired about 3 years ago, a number of newspapers ran headlines about me leaving the job, and one of them said, OED's chief word detective leaves after 37 years or something. I thought, well, that's quite a good description. And I think authors and publishers are always discussing titles, and they've often got different opinions. And I was quite keen that this should be called the word detective. And I think it works quite well, so I'm quite pleased with it, actually.
Yeah. What do you think of the word lexicographer?
Lexicographer, yeah. Often when journalists came around to see us in the department, we'd have to explain that we were dictionary compilers as well as lexicographers. They often said lexicographers for some reason. And then they, of course, get confused with entomologists and etymologists, people who study insects and people who study word origins. But, I mean, it's a nice enough word. It's good enough for Dr. Johnson, so it's good enough for me.
Yeah. So what exactly does that mean, though?
Somebody who writes about words, who compiles dictionaries. I mean, it's really defined as a dictionary compiler, but somebody who writes and collects words.
Yeah.
Well, and we've been doing that in English for about, I don't know, 400 years. The first English dictionary dates from the very beginning of the 17th century, and that wasn't a comprehensive dictionary of English. That was just a dictionary of hard words, which people might have found puzzling when they came across in books they were reading, often classical words. And it wasn't until later in the 17th century that we started to have a tradition of a dictionary containing all the words in the language rather than just the difficult ones. I mean, arguably, there's a good point about just having a text that tells you the difficult words, because you know the easy words, but it grew up as a tradition that you'd have a dictionary that contained all the words of the language.
Yeah. So why did you become a word detective?
Yeah, it's a bit puzzling to me as well. What happened originally was that I was just finishing off a master's in medieval studies at university in the mid-70s, and it was my girlfriend, my wife actually, later my wife, but saw an advert in the Times Literary Supplement for an editorial assistant on the Oxford English Dictionary, and thought I ought to maybe apply for it. And I thought, well, if that's what she thinks of me, I'm not sure how long this is all going to last. But anyway, I applied, and I found that I loved doing it. It was such a fantastic job, working out the history and origin of words throughout the centuries and seeing how that tied in with changing cultures.
Mm. But you don't think that you need to love words?
You have to, I mean, the dictionary editor has to be, as I mentioned, quite scientific about it. So I don't love words. No, I'm not. We're very suspicious of people who want to become lexicographers who love words. I mean, there's lots of places in the world where word lovers should be, but they aren't necessarily writing definitions about words, and they'd probably find it a bit dry anyway.
One of our listeners tweeted this question: I heard that dictionaries don't always define words accurately, and that their role is to reflect modern usage. Is this true?
It's quite a difficult. I mean, there are various sort of philosophical concepts involved there. We try to define words as they are used. So we work on maybe example sentences from large text corpora or newspapers or whatever, and we try and look at each word, each sense of a word, and see precisely how it's used and reflect that specifically in the definition. Now, if it's not being used in a way that you agree with, then you'll say that the dictionary isn't defining it correctly, or if you think that maybe a word ought to have its original historical etymological meaning and doesn't today, then you'll say that the dictionary is defining it wrongly. But you wouldn't define nice, for example, which used to mean ignorant, as meaning ignorant today. Things move on. So you have to be alert to the fact that language does change, can change quite quickly, and dictionaries are trying to capture the meaning as it's understood today, which may not be the same as either tomorrow or the day after.
We're talking with John Simpson. He's the former chief editor of the Oxford English Dictionary. He's also the author of the memoir, The Word Detective, Searching for the Meaning of It All at the Oxford English Dictionary. And you can ask him about the meaning of it all at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Is there a word that you would like to be added to the dictionary? Do you still use dictionaries? Why or why not? Do you love dictionaries? And we'll talk some when we come back about the future of dictionaries, too. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about words and the meaning of words and the origin of words and how words get into the dictionary. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for John Simpson, who is the author of The Word Detective, Searching for the Meaning of It All at the Oxford English Dictionary. And John Simpson is the former chief editor of the Oxford English Dictionary, where he helped take the dictionary online. And I wanted to ask you about that before we go to calls, John. So that's a massive undertaking, but dictionaries are evolving as well as our language, right?
Yep, that's right. When I first went through the doors of the OED in 1976, it was really rather an old-fashioned sort of. It was part of old-fashioned Oxford, and we were writing our definitions on index cards and piling up boxes worth of these index cards to send off to the printer for printing, etc. And it sort of started to look as if there wasn't going to be much of a much of a future for a big historical dictionary in multi-volumes like the OED. I mean, it's okay for the small desk dictionaries, but would a publisher want to carry on publishing supplement after supplement of a dictionary? And gradually we realized that things were happening outside of publishing in the area of technology. We didn't have the internet at the time. What we had was people starting to key their scholars keying historical texts onto magnetic tape or onto CDs and using those. And we thought, well, maybe if we can put the dictionary onto computer in this format. And at the time, we were thinking of magnetic tapes and CDs. Then maybe we can think about the possibility of actually updating and revising this 19th century dictionary and giving it more of a future. And gradually, we got the impression that we might be able to actually make it more accessible to people than it had been in the past in its big bound volumes if it was available on the internet.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you'd like to talk about words with John Simpson, the word detective. Kelly in Jefferson is with us. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Hardly, but be as brief as possible.
Okay. I love tea. You know, herbal tea.
Okay.
And I'm trying to get the right word that really, really describes how I love tea. You know,
I guess to say I'm a fan of tea doesn't really describe how much you absolutely adore or love something. I like it. I love it. She's looking for a word to describe people who really, really, really love tea.
Yeah. I wonder what that is. I mean, most words for people that love things are usually end in file. So an allurophile is a person who loves cats, for example. And so you'd need an equivalent for the word like charophile or something, or teophile at the beginning of that. You'd probably be looking for a Greek or Latin word for tea. I'm not sure whether they had the concept of tea in those days. So you might be stuck with a more recent term. I can't think of anything other than teophile at the moment, but it's not a very good one.
It's
difficult to invent words out of nowhere,
yeah.
Which is why, as I said before, we don't really do that. We take existing words and shuffle them a bit. But these words for people who love things, yeah, they are invented from time to time.
Yeah, thank you, Kelly. Edward in Lake Mills is with us. Hi, Edward.
Hi, Joy. Your show. It's always great. I wanted to just bring a little bit of maybe comic relief to how cold it is with just a word that popped into my head this morning as I was walking in my car would be a combination of frigid and braggadocio. Frigidocio, the way in which Wisconsinites seem to be able to tackle the cold weather almost with a certain arrogance seems like we have the ability, or maybe thicker blood it may be, than a lot of our other, a lot of the other folks in the country.
Frigidocio is what you said, Edward.
Yes.
That's
yes.
Funny. And we not only can tolerate these 30 below wind chills, John Simpson, we thrive in it. We love it.
We enjoy them as well. That's awful, yeah. Yeah, we don't get anything quite as cold as over here. In fact, we haven't had snow for several years, I don't think, at least not proper snow we used to in the old days. But frigidocio, yeah, that sounds quite fun. You'd need to get it used by lots of people before it found its way into the dictionary. But But on the other hand, it does represent, it does illustrate what I was saying before about words being invented by making use of elements of words that we already have. It's a bit like mizzle, which is a sort of light rain, is a mixture of mist and drizzle. So we quite like playing around with words and blending them and merging them together to create new ones. And Brexit itself is a merger of Britain and exit, for example. So yeah, people don't quite like creating new words like that.
Yeah, yeah, and I kind of kiddingly asked people to call in with how they felt about this weather and a word for cold. So thank you very much, Edward, for that. It did add a little levity.
Yeah, thank you.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Brian Shasso, my producer, did look up a word to see if she could find something that described what a tea lover might call oneself. Chamomile-a-phile. It's almost like chamomile tea with file at the end.
Yeah, that sounds possible, yeah. I thought I wouldn't cheat by looking in the dictionary to see if there was one while I was talking to you, and also you'd hear me clattering on the keys as well.
So
I thought I'd just behave.
Chamomile-a-phile. I'm not even sure how to pronounce that.
Yeah,
but,
that sounds like fun, yeah.
Tim in Columbus is with us. Hi, Tim.
Hello. I have a couple types of words that I really enjoy. One are words where the prefix or suffix has to be part of it. What I mean by that is you don't hear people use the root gruntled anymore. So you can be disgruntled, but very rarely do people use the word gruntle. I also like what I think are called contronyms, ones where the word is its own opposite. So if Sally left the room, who's left?
I'm sorry,
then,
who... Oh, I get it.
Yeah, who's left? Yeah.
And then
yep, that's right.
And then one last question that popped into my head that we were talking about over the dinner table the other day. We cannot think of a word that describes the feeling of like a Vicks Vapor Rub or that feeling when you drink a very strong alcoholic beverage and it's almost in your lungs.
Do you have any ideas for that one, John?
Not at the moment. I'll try this evening and see if I can work anything out.
Yeah, maybe we'll ask Brienne if she can see if there's... But yeah, it's the feeling of Vicks Vapor Rub, which is...
I don't think you'll find that as one of our definitions, but still. Those sort of fun words are... I mean, people enjoy the fun part of language, and one of the reasons I wrote the book was, in quite a conversational tone, was to try to get over to people the fun of working with words, as well as the traditional view, stereotypical view of lexicographers as being, you know, very elderly men with white beards and hardly able to walk around without a stick. So I was trying to give over some of that excitement about language that you feel in the difference between, you know, gruntled and disgruntled, or Lewis Carroll's chortling, for example, words coming out of...
why don't we say someone's gruntled?
Because I can't even remember if disgruntled was coined on gruntled with dis, or whether we had the word disgruntled in its own right and then developed gruntled from it, which we might well have done. The word inkling, for example, if you have an inkling of something, shows how words die in the past, because an inkling is just a hint of something and an idea of something, and it's ended ing, so it's a present participle sort of ending, and so you'd think there'd be a verb to inkle, which might mean to hint at something. And in fact, there was about 600 years ago, but we lost the verb, and all we have is the derivative part, an inkling, left from it. Language changes all the time, and we have to keep up with it.
Well, to show you that public radio is not stuffy, I'm going to share Mary's question, but we have to be careful about this. We cannot use the actual word on the air. And that being said, Mary in Wisconsin Rapids wants to know if you, Mr. Simpson, can explain where the F word came from.
It's not actually known precisely how it came into English. It's first recorded around the beginning of the 16th century, and there are comparable words in Northern Europe at the time and in Scandinavia, But it's because it's a word that wasn't widely used in early documents, it's actually quite difficult to trace back the origin. It's certainly a Germanic word. It certainly comes from that area of northern Germany that English came from originally in the first place. But it was probably underground because it wasn't used in official religious documents, for example, which are many of the documents that we have from the earliest period of the language are religious, and they wouldn't use that sort of language. So it's Germanic, and it came into English in the early 16th century. But beyond that, we can't precisely say, as we can't with many words, actually, this precisely is where it comes from. But northern German area in general.
Our guest is John Simpson. He is the author of The Word Detective, Searching for the Meaning of It All at the Oxford English Dictionary. He is the former chief editor of the Oxford English Dictionary, and he's here to talk about all things word-related. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Bill in Wauwatosa is with us. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Joy. My question has to do with expanding the use of the word like to what we used to refer to as Valley Girl speak, and I give an example. So I'm like going to the mall today.
Like.
I understand it is used commonly in that way. Every time I hear it, I'm an elderly male. It clanks in my ear. But I read recently, I believe, that the OED either has or is considering including it with that definition.
We included it several years ago, in fact, because it was widely used, and we don't say usages are good or bad. We just say they're out there. I found it a strange usage when I first. It came to Britain rather later than it came to California, for example. So we got it down the line. We started hearing it in America on American television programs first, and then people started using it themselves. It's the younger generation thing originally, but they're getting older, so older people are using it as well, but not probably as old as you or me, quite so much. So often with this sort of slang, there is a big generational divide, and it's the older people. Who usually end off at the worst end of it because it's the younger people are going to take over. So that you think, well, that's probably maybe more likely to survive than some of the older usages that I sort of cosset for my own childhood. So yeah, you just have to you sort of have to accept something sometimes that they're just taking over. On the other hand, it may have a short-term half-life. It may not last another 20 years. Somebody else may take over. So you can never tell where the language is going either.
And what word of speech
various spaces.
I'm sorry, Bill, go ahead.
What word of speech is it? Conjunction, verb, pronoun, or something else?
Yeah, it's... what do you call that? It becomes an interjection at some point. I mean, it's just like, you know, it doesn't really have a formal part of speech.
Bill, that clanks in his ear. I like that. We talked about how you liked the choice way back when, or not whenever it was, of the word selfie as the word of the year. Talk a little bit about the process of adding selfie in terms of adding that to the dictionary. What happens?
What happens is that initially what were originally the card files in Oxford, but are now large computer databases, start to contain a growing number of instances of a term used in real life sentences that have been collected, and the computer software or whatever, or people's realization of language change tells us that it's a word that we need to look at. So it ticks various boxes. So the editors start investigating it. I think when we first started investigating it, the evidence that we had for the expression dated from about 2010. So it was a fairly recent word as far as we were concerned, and that probably fitted our own recollection of it. I mean, I think I can remember it from 2010 or so when it was first emerging. And yet, on the other hand, when we started doing some detailed research on how old the expression was in the English language at as a whole, we found that we were looking in Australia around the year 2000, 2002, I think, the first recorded use we found anywhere. There was some sort of consistent use in Australia in 10 years or so before it came over here. So that was quite exciting for us because it was a sort of pocket of usage from a region of English which seemed to have dominated more widely after a 10-year period of growing, like a little a culture growing into something enormous in a petri dish or something.
Talk some about how the growth of technology plays into the development of new words.
Yeah, it's much easier to have a new expression sent all around the world the next day now than it was when the dictionary was first being compiled in the 1880s. I think I've already first noticed that when the Russian words perestroika and glasnost, if you remember, suddenly appeared on the scene, and they were used absolutely everywhere throughout all the journalist outfit on the news, or we started hearing it everywhere. And that completely contrasted with the way new words would have seeped into the language probably quite slowly in the old days. The new technology and communication ability has completely changed how some really high profile words can proliferate.
Charles on Facebook says, I love etymology. I have frequently enjoyed reading the OED to find the first recorded usage of a term. Having coined several words over the years, I think Charles is saying he coined these words, gerrymandate is one, hypocristy. I've heard gerrymandate. I have heard that. I wonder how much emphasis is placed on recording the first usage of new words in a time when of such rapid linguistic evolution.
We don't start at the beginning of a word's history. We start with our record of how frequent a word is, and then we try and trace it back to its earliest point. What's changed over the last 10 years or so in that area is we now don't simply rely on printed sources, which we had to do in history. But from about 10 years ago, we started accepting first usages from the internet, because that's where some words were first used. So we wouldn't want to miss the fact that a computer slang term was first used on computer, flaming somebody, for example, I think was one. And so, yeah, the technology has allowed us to become more accurate in terms of first usage, which is I wouldn't like to say it's an obsession of lexicographers, of historical lexicographers, but it's something that's very important to try to take the word back to when it first entered the language, because that's the point at which you can see why it might have entered the language and why it was appropriate at the time.
Yeah, I heard gerrymandate during our election discussions because certain politicians claiming they had a mandate. People were saying, "Well, that you know that your election was as a result of gerrymandering."
Gerrymandering,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, so then it became gerrymandate, and I heard it on our air.
Yeah, another of these mergers and blends that people are so keen on, because gerrymandering itself is an old word in English from about the 1890s, I think, and it seems to have arisen in the Liverpool area. So it's quite a regional word originally, which in its own, rather like selfie in Australia, becoming a universal word, gerrymandering from its origins in 1890s Liverpool became, had the same sort of mushrooming effect as well. And now you're saying it's blending onto another word and moving in a different area. Mm. Well, that's what words do. It's great to see it happening.
Yeah, well, all right. Well, Charles says he started it. We'll see if it ever becomes a word, gerrymandate.
Yeah.
We will continue our discussion with John Simpson, who is the author of a memoir, The Word Detective, Searching for the Meaning of It All at the Oxford English Dictionary. He is the former chief editor of the Oxford English Dictionary, where he helped take the dictionary online. And we are talking about how words get into the dictionary, how technology affects dictionaries and words and language. We're welcoming your questions about words. Maybe you made up some words. Maybe you need to know the origin of a word. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about words and dictionaries and how words get into dictionaries and welcoming your questions for our guest who knows all about this. He is the former chief editor of the Oxford English Dictionary. He is the author of his memoir, The Word Detective, Searching for the Meaning of It All at the Oxford English Dictionary. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You're talking about regional words just before the break, and it reminded me of John Simpson. Do you know what a bubbler is?
A bubbler?
Yeah, a bubbler.
No.
It's a regional. It's a Wisconsin word that is also used a little bit in of all things Massachusetts. It's the name that we use for a drinking fountain.
Oh, okay, a bubbler, yeah, okay. Well, there's a terrific dictionary called a multi-volume dictionary called the Dictionary of American Regional English,
yep,
which I'm sure would include that. Whether it gets into a dictionary like the OED depends on how widely it's used in regional use or dialect. So if it's just used in one or two states, we possibly wouldn't include it. But a word that's got a widespread use over a whole, the East Coast or the West Coast or the Midwest or something is quite likely to find its way into the dictionary. I don't know about bubbler. Words are always older than you think, so I wouldn't be surprised if it's there already, but I'm not going to cheat and look. I'll leave you to do that.
We will. It just occurred to me that it'd be interesting to see. Or maybe see if Cheesehead is in there, Brianne. Cheesehead is the name of Wisconsinites, because especially Packer fans that wear wedges of plastic cheese on our heads.
I don't believe that. I can't believe it. Dear me.
Just take a look at a Lambeau Field picture sometime. You'll see one. Norma in Madison is with us. Hi, Norma.
Hi. I'm wondering the difference between healthy and healthful, and if it's correct to say that a food is healthy.
It's not, but I say it all the time. Right, John Simpson?
Well, you probably can't. I mean, I'm not the sort of person to say the word is right or wrong. I'll probably try and tell you that one is more frequently used than another in a context. So you often hear that food is healthy, which means it's sort of health promoting or health giving. And so people will therefore who say that actually isn't what healthy means will try to use an expression like healthful, meaning giving, tending to give health in its place. So they'll grow up these two rival camps, maybe, and maybe other terms as well. That people will try and use for the same thing. Sometimes it's the sort of thing that marketing people get hold of to try to promote a new light on a product by saying that it's health dominant or something like that. So I wouldn't like to say that one's right or wrong. One is a more traditional word. One's a new idea that tries to get over the sense better. But they're probably both going to be used. I don't think one's going to see the other off.
Yeah. Let's go next to John in Green Bay. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. We were recently talking about technology and how words enter our common lexicon and usage and the blending together of words. And I was thinking about Urban Dictionary. I don't know if you have any experience with the social media site Urban Dictionary, where people can enter words that they've created. In fact, you were talking earlier about blending words. I created a word on Urban Dictionary called blurge, which is blend, merge. Blurge it together on Urban Dictionary.
Yep, that's right. It was one of my 10 favorite dictionaries, I think, something I wrote for a British newspaper earlier this week. So, yeah, I'm sort of familiar with what you can do there. And it's useful. It's interesting to me because it gives you an impression of what people think of are the ways in which words should be created. So it's not necessarily dealing with words that are, it is often dealing with words that are in widespread use, but it's also involved in new coinages. So it gives us, linguists an idea of what people feel are the most common ways to create new words. And often they are by blending together existing terms like that, because people find that as a fun way of creating language.
Yeah, The Urban Dictionary is, that's a dictionary of slang for the most part?
Yeah, mostly. I mean, it's just, it goes from personal words to slang words, probably more than, not formal concepts. That's a long way of saying yes. Sorry.
When does slang become a word in the Oxford English Dictionary?
A slang term, you mean? When does a slang mm-hmm. term become? As soon as it's widely used. The Oxford Dictionary isn't trying to promote formal English. It's just, as I've said, trying to describe all the languages out there. So if a slang term is widely used, exactly the same selection criteria are used for including it in the dictionary as for a formal word that you might hear on the evening news.
Yeah. By the way, Brianne looked up bubbler in the Oxford English Dictionary. No reference. It's there, but no reference to the way we use it in Wisconsin. So
yeah. Oh, well, we always like to leave things out so that we can add them in later. Keep us in a job, you see.
Hey, cheesehead is in the dictionary. It's used to describe a native or inhabitant of Wisconsin or a supporter of the Green Bay Packers, and it describes the hat worn. So that one made it there.
There we are. Yeah. Oh, well, as I say, we'll look there tomorrow. You won't be there that quickly. But, new words are being added every quarter, every 3 months to the dictionary, so keep on looking.
Yeah, well, it's there. Let's go next to Frenchie in Milwaukee. Hi, Frenchie.
Yeah, regarding the word oven, we'd never refer to any cooking device like an oven or a stove as a reheater. Why do we refer to a cooling device like a refrigerator as a refrigerator as opposed to a
refrigerator? Hey, I guess I never thought of that.
Yeah, not sure I thought of that either. They were called refrigerators, and then we shortened that to fridge, didn't we? And I suppose refrigeration was the
refrigeration
was the older term, making things cooler again. So it wasn't a device at the time; it was just a process of refrigerating. And I don't actually know. You'd have to look at the social history of what was happening when fridges came in at the beginning of the 20th century, early 20th century. But it was obviously a term that caught on. We don't refrigerate, do we? No.
No. It's all part of the wonder of language. It sounds like it almost refridge, doesn't it? Almost make it sound like we are making it cold again.
Right. Well, maybe there was some reason for that originally. I can't tell at the moment. It's an interesting question, though, because it just shows that even though you've been working on language all your life, there are still little questions that you haven't thought of before.
Yeah. Jim in Oshkosh is with us. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. I have a question about a very short word, used, U-S-E-D, how the dictionary treats this, because it has at least four meanings or usages, such as, I used to do that, I am used to that, I use that, I implement that, or it's used, pre-owned. A small word with, seems to me, a lot of permutations.
The difficulty with small words is that they're often used, and they get used in all sorts of different contexts. Something is used and pre-owned, it's probably being used as a participial adjective, whereas the other usages you had were verbs or past participles. I think it's in English, it's got I can't remember how many senses the verb use has in the OED, but it's going to be many more than four, and those will be the four that you may be most familiar with today. They're the tip of the iceberg as far as the different meanings the words had over the centuries, and that's what I find fun about looking at the history of the word. You can see all these little pinnacles and peaks, and then an enormous great mountain where the most common meanings today are found. So yeah, there are more meanings of use than that if you really look around.
mm-hmm. It's David in Madison is with us now. Hi, David.
Hi, I had a question. When you were talking about the OED isn't trying to create a formal English, I remember from college hearing that I think that there were bodies or academies in other countries like perhaps France or Spain where they actually are trying to prevent the language from skewing certain ways. I just was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah, that's right. Britain and America are quite unusual in not seeming to want anyone to regulate their language. At the government level, or at the popular level, there are some states in America where English is the official language, I think, but it's not the official language of America in general, because there isn't an official language, and same as in Britain, there's not a constitution, there's not an official language regulated by a constitution. Some countries, such as France, Spain, some of the European languages have academies which... And they're often trying to counter these days the effect of the English language, the spread of the English language through British and American culture throughout Europe. I mean, you may not realize it, but a lot of postgraduate university teaching is done in English in Europe, and that's something that that upsets many people in Holland, for example, in the Netherlands, because they see it as a way of excluding their language from developing into to having words to describe concepts that that English has. So if you're using the English term, then you won't develop a Dutch or a Spanish or a French term for it. And so often these academies nowadays are looking at English words that are being used in their own language and trying to find equivalents from their own native word stock to change them. I don't know how successful that's going to be, because people will use the language they want, and they'll use the language that's if they're attracted to a particular culture, they'll be attracted to the words of the culture. And so as long as American culture, American language, British language and British culture is attractive to other people, they'll use those words. And so the academies will have have plenty of work to do, but also it'll be a difficult job to make those sort of changes.
Barbara in Janesville has been waiting. Hi, Barbara.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question about the origin and the, I guess, degree of negativity of the word gutter snipe.
Mm-hmm. I think it would in British English it would be regarded as fairly negative. I can't think of a good concept in which you call somebody a gutter snipe.
Yeah, and we looked it up.
Is that the same in American English?
Just to make sure, it's a gatherer of refuse, or a child brought up in the gutter, or a type of printed bill. So.
Those are the older meanings, and nowadays it's just used for somebody who is, you're trying to be sort of disrespectful to, I suppose. So, yeah, I think it's generally, nowadays, it's regarded as a negative term. Do you use it in a positive, with positive connotations in American English?
No, unfortunately, I use it as you were saying, you know, someone brought up in the gutter, in other words, kind of a low, what we call a low life. And
you're just wondering where that came from, the origin of that word.
The origin of it, yeah. Just from the word
gutter.
I'm not sure about the snipe part of it. I mean, a snipe is a name for a bird, but whether that's somebody who just picks around in the gutter, that's possibly what it is. I'd have to check on the dictionary.
Just a minute ago, and I wanted to ask you before. What do you think is the future of dictionaries?
People are often tending to just look up meanings of words online without going to a dictionary, just to seeing what online sources say. I mean, they're dictionaries in their own right often. But I think there's a sort of certainty and solidity about printed dictionaries that I think education systems are going to find hard to give up. I think as far as historical dictionaries are concerned, the online dictionary is the way that sort of massive text can be best held.
Yeah.
So I think big historical dictionaries are likely to be largely online dictionaries because they're not practical as printed dictionaries. But I think small dictionaries, smaller dictionaries, desk dictionaries, do have a future.
Thank you, John Simpson, author of The Word Detective. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.